correct me, but it was that the world is fire, right? There's this fundamental element of fire in the world. And then obviously with the Pythagoreans, it was effectively number, a kind of, you might even call it numerology. Then you go into Heraclitus, and this is a gross, simplification, but the world is some kind of flux change. That's not really correct, but we can, for the purpose of this discussion, we can keep it that vague. And Parmenides is a little bit outside of that, but the world is one, actually just one thing. Then you get to Plato, and you effectively, at least many will criticize, and I guess you could call it a criticism, and say that what Plato is doing is a more articulated version of this, that the world is effectively a reflection of form, of perfection, of good, and then Aristotle has a re-articulation of that. The point being that it's kind of said at the beginning that there are two thinkers who are both operating within the confines of the intellectual pursuits of the ancient world. And they've got a very particular kind of method, which is always looking for that is, Brandon said, the kind of final cause, that most fundamental thing, the most basic, conceptually speaking, and that is something that really the modern thinkers and scientists, quote unquote, and stuff like that, are attempting to turn away from. Obviously, the criticism, as said, can be turned around and said, well, now we've entered an age in which, the scientific method and materialism, as its correspondent, are considered the only ways of doing things, and everything has to operate within that framework. So the same sort of structure is still happening. It's just a different framework.
I just want to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and on today's episode, we are discussing the differences between Plato and Aristotle on our journey through the history of Western philosophy. We've discussed a little bit about the idea of forms, Plato's ideal of forms, that there is an ideal set of objects, abstract objects, that represent the world. And that we can correctly see the world as physical objects that have links and correspond to the true ideal objects, the forms. Whereas Aristotle says that forms exist, but forms exist within objects, within physical objects. They don't correspond to perfect immaterial objects that are abstract. Rather, forms exist within objects as part of those objects, and they cease to exist when that object ceases to exist. So they are temporal, they exist within time and space. I wanted to talk about the development of mathematics, because you can actually see the development of mathematics from either this Aristotelian perspective or the Platonic perspective. You can see the development of mathematics as being the discovery of a set of true ideal forms. When we invent the idea of numbers, well, numbers reflect some fundamental reality that has always existed, and that's why no matter what type of number system you use or counting system, it's fundamentally the same thing. There's only one set of prime numbers. No matter how you write the number 7, it represents something physical in the real world. I'm so Aristotelian, I can't stop myself. It represents something in the abstract world that is true and ideal. Or you can say it represents something in the real world. Now, most modern mathematicians, I would say, are quite Aristotelian in that sense, where they want to say that their abstractions are good abstractions because they represent real-world processes and can predict them or explain them with great fluency and great accuracy and precision. Our mathematics, then, as a product of humanity, is something that has its form within humanity and is exclusive to only humanity. You could also say that mathematics isn't Aristotelian in nature, it's Platonic in nature, and so mathematics is the same for us, and it's the same for the Vulcans and their alien planet, and any other alien or any other species or any other artificial intelligence that develops. We'll necessarily have to use the same type of mathematics we use, because that's like a fundamental law of how the universe works. So honestly, I don't know which of these are correct, and I also don't know if mathematicians in general would agree or disagree that this question is worth asking or has already been solved. I do want to mention that some people have postulated, especially in the Middle Ages, that essentially mathematics was like thinking God's thoughts after him. So this is a very Christianized idea where essentially, you know, God, if such a being as the Christian God existed, he would have perfect knowledge of all knowledge that exists, and mathematical knowledge being this Platonic perfect knowledge that's immaterial, God already knows all of it, and so then if human beings learn it, then, you know, they're just learning something God already knows. Of course, on the other side of things, you can argue it that God is not a human being, doesn't exist in the form of a human being, and so therefore, from the Aristotelian perspective, mathematics is not something that God will ever understand from the human perspective, because he is not in the form of a human being. It does not need in his experience. So I hope that our other co-hosts on the show find this interesting, and I'll leave this to you and see what your thoughts are.
Yeah, it's I'm glad you're kind of stuck on the two horns here, because there wouldn't be this two-way street running throughout the history of Western philosophy if both schools, Aristotelianism and Platonism, didn't offer a compelling picture of the world. You know, we have this Platonic notion. We encounter this Platonic experience all the time where, wow, things seem to work by virtue of the fact that they're almost imbued in the universe itself. Numbers just are consistent with the universe. It seems to be a property of reality, of what is most real. But then on the other hand, we have the Aristotelian experience where we have derived all kinds of logical axioms from our own reasoning processes. I mean, the Aristotle's logic is basically a rigidification is kind of a pejorative, but it is a bit of a rigidification or an examination of the logic of our own reasoning processes, that there are contradictions in the way that we can think. There's the contraries. The way that we articulate thoughts has a certain structure that has truth value independent of its content, and all of these were necessary steps to formulating the logical axioms for things like computer science and mathematical logic and whatnot, which it's kind of arriving at the same thing through a different path. But again, we're stuck on these horns because both of them are very compelling pictures. The ambiguity is, I think, valuable. It's worth being stuck on. It keeps you engaged. It keeps you wondering for both sides. Platonism offers a very he's associated with the idealism of philosophy, because we have perfect knowledge. Numbers really are what we think they are. We don't have to approximate on them. The numerals that they represent and the amounts and the quantities, they are exactly as our mind conceives them, because we have access to them as they are. And yet on the other side, we have the evidence of, well, we've had to do a lot of hard work, a lot of hard Aristotelian work to figure out these rules. And they seem to come from, not in like an anthropocentric sense that they're dependent on us, but we have had to do a lot of empirical examination of our world to get to where we have arrived in logic, which, just to bring it back, both of these are kind of aiming at the same goal.
Yeah, You know, I think I'm going to have a lot less of like an articulate thing to say on this point, but I'll say it anyways. You know, this discussion has come up before. I can remember numerous times in classes in philosophy and such. And what's always come to my mind is I have personally always really struggled with the concept that, you know, we're going to take numbers, just an example, but this can be extended to any sort of thing you might consider a universal. And you can even go deeper than that, I think. But basically, that, like, if there were no beings, as in, like, conscious beings, whatever you might call it, thinkers of some kind, observers, actors of some kind of way, where would something like numbers go? Where would they be? And it's a problem, and it's actually a problem that, like, can extend to almost everything. The problem is that, well, part of the problem of the problem is that then it kind of, sort of hints at this, as Brandon also mentioned, a sort of dependency of everything on us. I think that's a bit of a, while there's some truth to that, I think it's not quite as simple as, like, you know, I just make stuff up. Like, it's not actually a regress into subjectivity in its most, like, virulent forms. But it is, I've always really struggled with this notion that somehow, like, numbers, in the Platonic sense, universals are, like, out there. We just have some sort of weird, indefinable access to them, but they're out in the world, like, doing stuff independent of us. They're there. We discovered them. And it just seems... it's very strange to me. Like, it's a very, I've never really been able to get on board. I don't really, yeah, that's really all, that's always what comes to my mind when we have this conversation. Is that, like, where are the numbers? Where'd they go? Like.
and I think that is a frustration that a lot of people have, where it's just like, if you get rid of all of the material world, what do you have? And a lot of people just say you have nothing. Like, there's nothing that exists. Well, what about the immaterial things? Is there such a thing as an immaterial thing without a material context? Well, because we live in the material world, if such a thing existed, we would have no ability to prove whether it existed, or no knowledge of such. So it's kind of a meaningless question, which is interesting to think about, but fundamentally useless at the practical level, which I'm very sorry to say it that way. I hope I'm not offending too many philosophers by saying it that way, but we live in the modern age, and we want to be more realistic. I wanted to bring up something else about the history of mathematics, and I'm sorry that hopefully this doesn't depart too much from, since we're supposed to be talking about Aristotle, but in the 19th century, there was a really new movement in mathematics towards more rigorous mathematics. And what that means is there was a development in mathematical ideas to systematize mathematics at higher and higher levels of abstraction. And that if you can systematize a type of mathematics like geometry at higher levels of abstraction, then you can understand it differently and better, and you can find when you have a more abstract idea of what something is, you can find out the flaws in reasoning much easier. So, for instance, once this rigorous method was applied, it was discovered that Euclid's Elements, the greatest or the oldest mathematics textbook of all time, depending on who you're talking to, had some fundamental errors in it. And it was because of this rigorous method in mathematics that essentially what you want to optimize for when creating mathematical knowledge is highest level of abstraction possible. Of course, working with the same, from a systematic base that has real world correspondence or some kind of correspondence that can be easily understood by any human being, which fundamentally it always breaks down to real world correspondence, at least for me. Like there isn't a single mathematical concept where it's like you can't put it in an object, a situational context, like some type of story or example, because the minute you can't do that, and I mean there are abstract examples where like that really doesn't work with a lot of mathematical concepts at the higher levels of abstraction. But if you can't break something down to a lower level of abstraction eventually, and I'm sorry that this, hopefully this is somewhat coherent, but let me put it like this then. Higher level abstractions need lower level abstractions to work, fundamentally speaking. But Aristotle and Plato, I feel like they are trying to create a system where everything is at the same level of abstraction. They don't want, and maybe that was part of their culture, as Hale mentioned earlier, this idea that they want one fundamental concept to explain things, like where you have fire or change or flux or number. You have this one medium that you're interpreting reality through. I'm being really fancy here and bringing in some of our discussions from history of technology, but it's really interesting for me specifically just to think about, what about levels of abstraction and how does that apply to philosophy? Certainly it applied in 19th century mathematics, 20th century mathematics, 21st century mathematics, but what about the Enlightenment? Did the Enlightenment seek to create levels of abstraction, or is that just a fundamental misunderstanding? Yeah, so I'll open the floor once again. Hopefully that was an interesting tangent.
No, yeah, it's a good question, especially this question of, well, the Greek preoccupation with having the one answer to everything, you know, everything is, for the pre-Socratics, you can explain everything is water, or everything is fire, or everything is one, or everything is number, or everything is form. I mean, what is up with that? That's a good question. I think we would have to dive a bit more into the pre-Socratics to figure that out, and maybe give them a bit more attention than we can give them right now. But I will say about the other thing you were saying about levels of abstraction, I think that is a good question. It's a good thing to flag. I think Aristotle actually anticipates this. I think he would understand things in terms of what you were saying, levels of abstraction. In a kind of way, I actually think that Aristotle, how do I want to say it, breaks your rule that you're setting here. You know, we want multiple levels of abstraction. We don't want to reduce everything to one principle or one thing. But yet Aristotle would say, well, everything has form, and it's informed in a way. The matter is informed. And yet you can kind of have multiple things in a single thing. And I'm wondering if this maybe answers your question about levels of abstraction. So for the example that I'm thinking of, let's take a human. Humans have organs. Their organs have forms. You can give them teleological explanations, material, formal, efficient explanations. But that doesn't... organs and things like sense organs and whatnot, they don't... even though those parts have functions, they don't exhaust the higher level being that they are a part of. So say, for example, a human can be taken at that level of abstraction. You can understand a human at a lower level of abstraction. Say if you're an optometrist and you need to understand an eye as a whole, and then you need to understand the parts of the eye. You can also abstract up. You could be a political scientist and understand human communities. I think that way of seeing things is entirely consistent with Plato. I think it's also consistent, it's consistent with Aristotle, and it's also consistent with Plato. I think Plato would also say that there are things like the form of justice, which would include other things like the form of a human, because justice finds itself manifested in our world, at least through action. And Plato recognized that humans can act. The relation between that is a little bit more murky, but in terms of this like nested idea of abstractions and seeing things in terms of beings that way, I think that's more amenable to an Aristotelian perspective, though. I hope that answers your question, because as far as I understand what you mean by levels of abstraction, maybe this doesn't actually anticipate abstract concepts, but again, we're dealing with very early thinkers who are anticipating these things, so hopefully I have given that way of thinking its due.
Yeah, and the reason that I keep going back to the history of mathematics is because that is a very, very, very simplified version of the history of Western thought. Like, the history of mathematics is like one strand of the tapestry that is, you know, Western philosophy. So what I'm trying to elucidate here and inspire our listeners to think about is how the fundamental ideas of Plato and Aristotle affected the history of Western philosophy in many different ways. And so I hope that people who listen to this, they come away with a little bit of wonder and excitement of that they can, you know, go out and study things. And when they study things, they can think about how that came to be in different ways.
Yeah, I think, and I'll jump in just basically on what you were saying there, Aaron, and relating to something that Brandon brought up earlier, which was going back to Aristotle and Plato's obsession with first principles. Aaron, as you just said, oh, well, a big part of this discussion and kind of figure this out is how have these major thinkers affected modern thought today? And obviously, like I was saying, sorry, my whole explanation here is kind of convoluted. Obviously, they were coming from a position of looking for first principles, trying to figure out how the world works, and having this sort of background assumption that, you know, if you think hard enough, if you study hard enough, if you understand enough, you can know the nature of reality. You can figure it all out. I think for our listeners, a really interesting step away from that in the philosophical tradition is especially getting into the 19th century, when we get into the realm of what we call existentialism, there's basically a whole philosophical movement, which I believe its core on some level is relating to the fact of rejecting that whole notion. Basically, like, the world isn't something we will ever fully grasp. You're not going to get it. It's not going to have answers like that you're like Plato and Aristotle were looking for. How do you, like, in light of that truth, who are you and how do you deal with that? How do you make sense of the world as best, and probably most importantly, yourself and your own existence, obviously. And so I think that's a really interesting vein in seeing how these like key ancient thinkers and their more general basic traditions and assumptions, even in the process of their rejection, really form or at least inspire much more modern ways of thinking. And I think by and large, like, we are still living in a world that's facing the repercussions of that. Like, the world doesn't have these like the grand answers that I'm looking for, that I hope for. It doesn't seem that way. And so now, like, where do I find meaning? How do I understand myself? What the heck is going on? And I really think that, like, we owe that kind of angst, for lack of a better way of saying it, to the assumptions that Plato and Aristotle put up thousands of years ago.
Even in Plato and Aristotle's time, I think they were very stressed out and very angsty in their own lives, even though we don't always hear that through what remains of their work, through what has survived. I think it would be very true to say that, you know, they did stress out over a lot of things. They had a lot of problems in their eras of history, even though, you know, they may have believed that they could improve their situation in life by a better understanding or a better relationship with the one true being. That didn't mean that they were just, you know, fundamentally always at peace and had this monk-like Zen existence where all is philosophy and I am philosophy and I is philosophy, all is philosophy, all is well. I don't really think that there have, like, from what I've seen, I don't know of any philosophers like that. I mean, if you read a philosopher like that, I think that's basically all they have to say to you, isn't it? Like, everything is fine, so I don't have to write any more philosophy. And that's not that that isn't a valid perspective, but it's very hard to spend a lot of time digging into that and interpreting it when it's that short and succinct. I think that something that I would like to leave our listeners on is, can there be multiple forms, higher level forms, or what does it mean to have multiple higher level forms? Because both Plato and Aristotle appeal to this kind of one essence, one being, which is the truest form. And if you understand the truest form by understanding the lesser forms, then you have grasped what reality is. What would it mean to reject that? Do you then believe that there are only lesser forms and no higher level and no higher form that they relate to? Would you then believe that there are multiple, perhaps two or three or four or five or however many you want, higher level forms, and that they are in some way sometimes equivalent to each other? All right. You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show with Aaron Wang, Brandon Brownlee, and Hale Rotary.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.
This is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.